To wish you a very happy early birthday. I don't know if we can use happy in these dire times, but have a good one.
Thank you.
And a safe one. Oh, and of course, wear a mask, stay safe, save lives. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Adriano Contreras. Special thanks to our general manager, Julie Crosby, Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Dennis Moynihan, Paul Powell. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices for Justice and Radical Healing. From Tuesday, October 6th through October 15th, streaming online. Voices for Justice and Radical Healing is an online speaker series in support of Living Yoga's trauma-informed services. Speakers will explore ways to create healing for individuals, systems, and culture through body-based practices. Again, that's Voices for Justice and Radical Healing from Tuesday, October 6th through October 15th, streaming online. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Do you believe in the power of community radio? Then show your support by donating to KBOO today. We have a fundraising goal of $80,000, and we need listeners like you to help us get there. Show your support for non-commercial, people-powered community radio by going to kbu.fm and clicking on the donate button to become a member.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, new evidence has emerged in the extrajudicial killing of Michael Reinl. City Auditor Mary Hull Caballero faces four lawsuits over Mayor Ted Wheeler's campaign finance violations, and the Supreme Court has allowed the Trump administration to cut the census short this year. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 14th, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. On Wednesday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 390 new confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19, bringing the total number of cases in Oregon up to 38,160. Health officials reported three new deaths on Wednesday, bringing the total death toll up to 608. Multnomah County reported 88 cases, Marion County 63, and Lane County had 60 cases. The state received an influx of test kits, meaning a whopping 10,000 people were tested yesterday. Nationally, the number of cases in the U.S. continues to rise as the virus spreads largely unchecked in the Rocky Mountains and Upper Midwest. As of Wednesday afternoon, more than 8 million people have tested positive for the virus. At least 216,000 people have died. Globally, over 38 million people in nearly every country have contracted the virus. As of Wednesday, at least 1 million people have died. Healthcare providers are preparing for flu season as COVID-19 cases in many states continue to rise. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Health professionals are concerned about the overlap this winter of flu season and the COVID-19 pandemic and are asking that people prepare themselves. Raj Sundar, a family medicine physician for Kaiser Permanente and Burien, says the colder weather will make it especially tricky for avoiding coronavirus and the flu as activities move inside. He says there's also concern about how the viruses will interact with each other.
There are a lot of complications that can happen if you not only get the flu and the coronavirus or COVID-19 at the same time, but we know if you experience the flu that you're prone to complications if you subsequently contract COVID-19.
While there's not yet a vaccine for COVID-19, Sundar points out that a vaccine is available for the seasonal flu. He advises people to contact their doctors about getting a flu shot and says folks can find locations for those vaccinations online at getmyflushot.org. And the need for basic hygiene can't be overstated. Washing hands regularly, keeping them away from your face, and avoiding people who are sick. Sundar says avoiding the flu will help healthcare professionals as well.
Healthcare system resources are already strained, so having complications from the flu will not only strain the healthcare system even more, but will put you at risk not getting the care you need because of our current pandemic.
He notes people of color have historically faced disproportionate effects from the flu, and so prevention in communities of color is especially important. He says flu activity in the Southern Hemisphere has been lower than usual, which could be a good sign for the United States as winter approaches in this hemisphere. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
New additional corroborating evidence shows that Michael Reinl, who killed Patriot Prayer member Aaron J. Danielson, had his pistol in his pocket when police fired over 30 rounds and murdered him in Olympia, Washington last month. The night of September 3rd, officers from several agencies arrived at the apartment Reinl had fled to after the shooting in Portland. Several residents of the apartment complex, including someone who lived in the apartment where Reinl was staying, said the police gave no warning before they began shooting at Reinl, who was getting into his car. Residents say the officers in question did not flash any lights or indicate in any other way that they were part of law enforcement. Officers were wearing plain clothes, including cargo shorts, which may have led Reinl to believe they were members of the far right seeking retribution. Police claim they told Reinl to, quote, stop and show his hands before they began shooting. In conflicting reports, one officer said Reinl had pointed a gun at him, while another officer said Reinl was reaching into his pocket for a gun. The officers were not wearing body cameras. The day before his murder, Reinl admitted in an interview with Vice reporter Donovan Farley that he had indeed killed Danielson, but that he had acted in defense of himself and a companion. Danielson had been armed with a gun, a police-style baton, and bear spray. An hour before Reinl's extrajudicial killing, the President of the United States, Donald Trump, called on Portland police to arrest the, quote, cold-blooded killer. Later, the president described the killing as, quote, retribution. Portland City Auditor Maryhole Caballero faces four lawsuits over Mayor Ted Wheeler's campaign finance violations. Voters overwhelmingly voted for campaign finance reforms in a 2018 ballot measure. The reforms changed the city charter to include individual donor limits, candidate disclosure of top donors, and limits to self-funding by candidates. Wheeler's campaign is in violation of all three of those changes. According to OPB, the auditor's office relies on court precedent in choosing which violations to enforce. Hull Caballero didn't enforce the $500 individual donor limits during the primaries until after the Oregon Supreme Court ruled in favor of the limits. Wheeler's campaign was in violation of this provision, but was not fined retroactively. In April, Wheeler's campaign was found to be unlawfully withholding his top campaign donors in advertisements and on his website. The auditor gave Wheeler a deadline for including this information. Wheeler complied. This month, Sarah Iannarone, the challenger for the mayoral seat, filed a complaint with the auditor's office after learning Wheeler donated $150,000 to his own campaign. The auditor's office says it will not enforce limits on how much candidates may loan themselves, saying that without precedent, the case wouldn't hold up in court. With four pending court cases, precedent may be here sooner than expected. Wheeler has appealed decisions resulting in fines this summer over violations of individual donor limits twice. He's now taking the auditor to court over two of these decisions. Ayanna Rohn is also suing the auditor's office for allowing Wheeler to get away with his personal donation. Activist Ron Boole has an ongoing case against the auditor also related to Wheeler's lack of accountability. City Attorney Tracy Reeve wrote to recuse herself from representing the auditor's office. She says her involvement with Wheeler's campaign this summer is a conflict of interest. Auditor Hull Caballero told OPB that litigation involving the city auditor is not common. She said, quote, "This is wildly unusual." The Supreme Court ruled yesterday that the administration can order the census to stop early this year. The ruling reverses decisions by lower courts requiring that the Trump administration keep counting until October 31st, granting an emergency stay requested by Trump's Department of Justice. While the court's order was unsigned, Justice Sonia Sotomayor issued a dissent in which she wrote, quote, "Significantly, the percentage of non-responses is likely much higher among marginalized populations and in hard-to-count areas, such as rural and tribal lands." Also, a lower court has blocked the administration's plans to exclude undocumented immigrants from the census, and on Friday, the Supreme Court will discuss whether or not to review the matter as the administration has requested. The state of Oregon has experienced the most job loss for its population size in recent years in the entire United States. KBOO's Brian Oster brings us this story.
Oregonians continue to see their work go elsewhere because of trade-related job loss. According to an analysis, the state has been the hardest hit for its population size in recent years. The Trade Justice Education Fund, or TJEF, analyzed U.S. Labor Department data and finds nearly 11,400 jobs left between 2017 and 2019, compared with about 10,000 between 2014 and 2016. Nate Aldrich, a former machinist for Boeing, is one of the folks that saw his work disappear. He says he thought Boeing was insulated from this trend.
Now we're having the same issues at one of the largest aerospace manufacturers in the world, so it's a little frustrating.
TJEF reviewed data from the federal government's Trade Adjustment Assistance Program, which provides unemployment benefits to workers who have been deprived of their jobs because of outsourcing or displacement by imports. Hillary Hayden, a local organizer for the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign, says the trade deal with China has protected big corporations that move their jobs overseas. She adds that the 2017 tax law, which was a major priority for the Trump administration, has incentivized making goods outside the U.S. Under the law, the federal tax rate for goods made in the country is 21%, while income earned offshore is taxed at half that rate.
We're seeing a lot of these policies come out of the Trump administration that are really explicitly targeted at facilitating the move of jobs to other countries.
But Hayden says the Northwest can bring back production. One route could be the push to, quote, buy clean.
Buying products that are less carbon intensive on the environment than other products. And what we find is Washington and Oregon have some of the cleanest materials in the whole world because of the standards that our state legislatures have set for manufacturing in our state.
In the short term, the report also suggests moving production of COVID-19 protective equipment from overseas to the U.S. For KBOO Evening News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Brian Oster.
A former prosecutor and doctor used their life experiences to make a case for drug decriminalization. Eric Tegedoff with the Public News Service has more on that story.
Oregonians in law enforcement and medicine are supporting a measure to decriminalize drug possession and fund addiction treatment. It would reclassify drug possession as a misdemeanor and direct marijuana tax revenue over $11.25 million to the Drug Treatment and Recovery Services Fund. Inga Frickland is a former prosecutor in Chicago who now lives in Bend. She's changed her mind on the war on drugs, noting racial disparities in arrests, and now says drug use should be treated as a health issue.
What we were doing wasn't helping people who were on drugs, wasn't making the world any safer, and we were damaging the individual people who were getting arrested. And I started thinking about the knock-on effects for their families.
The measure has support from groups including the Law Enforcement Action Partnership and Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. But opponents say it will lead to increased drug use and crime rates. And the advocacy group Oregon Recovers says Measure 110 is poorly written and dismantles one system of intervention before building a new system. Willie Foster, an emergency physician in Florence, also volunteers at free clinics for people experiencing homelessness in the Eugene area. He supports the measure, noting the treatment options that potentially will come from it are most important. Foster says he has few options for people who come to the hospital for issues related to drug use.
The best clinics are going to be ones that don't just say, oh, here, take this medicine for your addiction, but really treat the whole person in terms of getting them job training, housing, all that kind of stuff, because that's just as vital in addressing these addiction issues.
Oregon ranks 48th for the percentage of people who are able to access drug treatment, with more than 280,000 not receiving the care they need, according to federal data. Projections estimate the measure would bring in between $103 million and $159 million a year for substance use disorder services. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KABU Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KABU membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned for an in-depth look at Measure 109, the Psilocybin Program Initiative, which will be on the ballot this November. At 6, it's Right to Survive, then stick around for Hard Knock Radio at 7. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 43, and tomorrow expect sunny skies with a high of 64. Today in history, in 1964, activist and minister Martin Luther King Jr. received the Nobel Peace Prize. He was assassinated in 1968. The quote of the day is from King, who said, quote, "In the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends." Native American groups across the country are condemning the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to stop the 2020 census count early this year. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick, in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Supreme Court on Tuesday granted a request by the Trump administration to suspend an order by a lower court that would have allowed the 2020 census count to continue through October. The move was condemned by the National Congress of American Indians, the Native American Rights Fund, and the National Urban Indian Family Coalition, who said the administration is trying to end the 2020 census count early in order to control the apportionment numbers, which determine the number of each state's congressional representatives. A group of Native American tribes, advocacy groups, cities, and counties had sued to maintain an extended deadline for the count, originally put in place by the U.S. Commerce Secretary in April because of the COVID-19 pandemic that was later reversed. NCAI said in a statement that the administration's efforts will, quote, result in incomplete numbers, effectively excluding non-citizens and suppressing the count of minority communities, including American Indians and Alaska Natives. The Supreme Court's ruling puts the count on hold while the Trump administration and advocates argue in a federal appeals court. NCAI is urging the legislative extension of deadlines, warning stopping the census will, quote, condemn Indian country to a loss of political representation and its fair share of resources for the next decade. This year, the FCC opened a window of opportunity for Native Americans to secure rights to their own wireless broadband networks. As Jacob Resnick reports, regional tribes such as Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska are working to establish an intertribal broadband network to improve internet connectivity across coastal Alaska.
Southeast Alaska tribes have few communities connected by road, and while the internet has helped bridge gaps from physical distances, it's often far from fast or reliable. Tribal Vice President Will Micklin says Tlingit and Haida is among hundreds of tribal entities nationwide to apply for a special wireless spectrum license to fill gaps in communities underserved by commercial carriers.
We don't have a profit motive. Our motive is a delivery of service. I really view broadband as an inherent right for our tribal citizens, and that is made ever clearer to me by the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic, where deficiencies in infrastructures became ever more apparent.
This year, the FCC made that possible by offering a spectrum for wireless broadband to native communities. Any unclaimed bandwidth will be auctioned off later to private carriers. But first, the FCC will need to issue the licenses. And when it does, hundreds of tribes across the U.S. are expected to have a unique opportunity to fill gaps in connectivity in underserved areas, which describes most of rural Alaska. For National Native News, I'm Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Alaska.
The Alaska Supreme Court ruled this week that people voting by mail will not need a witness to sign their ballots. KTOO reported the Arctic Village Council and others had sued to block the signature requirement because of the COVID-19 pandemic. The Anchorage Superior Court ruled in their favor, but the Division of Elections appealed it to the state Supreme Court. Natalie Landreth is with the Native American Rights Fund and represented the plaintiffs. She told the court voters at a higher risk for the virus, including Arctic Village residents, face a choice between their health and casting their ballots.
It's not worth it to vote if I have to expose myself to this illness for another person. And I think that's the problem, the unpredictability and the fear that we're putting on voters. Now, the pandemic is not the state's fault, but the requirement is.
The attorney for the Division of Elections argued changing rules in the middle of the election will confuse voters and that the plaintiffs didn't prove getting a witness is a severe burden. The court will issue a full opinion at a later date. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
Yesterday marked the start of early voting in Texas, as well as deadlines for voter registrations in six states, including Virginia, where the voter registration website crashed. With more on those stories, we turn to Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
This year, more than ever, people, at least here in Texas, are extremely eager to vote. If that means waiting in lines for hours with a mask on, you know, they're going to do it.
Reporter Eric De La Garza with Courthouse News in San Antonio, Texas, spoke with voters in line yesterday for their first day of early voting. He reports a lot of enthusiasm despite hours-long lines. There were even lines for ballot drop boxes after a federal court recently upheld the restriction of one per Texas county, no matter how large. Deadlines yesterday for voter registration in Kansas, Louisiana, New Jersey, Oregon, Virginia, and West Virginia. Virginia's voter registration website went down for hours because of an accidentally cut cable. Governor Ralph Northam supports an extension.
We're working with the courts, looking at all our options to extend the deadline for registration so that if there's time that people have lost, they'll be able to accommodate that.
Northam also may have been a second target of the plot thwarted by the FBI to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer and storm the state capitol. Northam's statewide stay-at-home order in March drew ire from the president, who at the time falsely tweeted that Virginia was, quote, under siege.
When language is used such as to liberate Virginia, people, they find meaning in those words, and thus these things happen, and that's regrettable.
During Trump's Supreme Court nominee Judge Amy Coney Barrett's second day of confirmation hearings, 88 of her faculty colleagues from the University of Notre Dame publicly asked her to halt the nomination until after the election, saying her acceptance at this time would, quote, undermine confidence in the court, unquote, among other things, though faculty from the law school have supported her nomination. At the hearing, Barrett declined to answer whether it's illegal to intimidate voters at polling places. It is, or whether the president has the authority to delay the election, he does not.
If I give off-the-cuff answers, then I would be basically a legal pundit, and I don't think we want judges to be legal pundits.
She also declined to say if she would recuse herself from the upcoming Affordable Care Act case. In the past, she criticized the court for declining to strike down a key part of the law. The same day, the current Supreme Court ruled the Trump administration can halt the census now to meet upcoming reporting deadlines. Despite delays due to the pandemic, it had been extended from July. Lawyer Yurish Rudensky with the Brennan Center for Justice says already marginalized communities are hurt most by an inaccurate count.
These are poor areas. These are areas that are predominantly people of color. It's where a lot of young people live, around colleges and universities, immigrant communities, and communities with a lot of children.
And on Twitter, Utah Senator Mitt Romney condemned both President Trump and a couple high-profile Democrats for making political debate a, quote, hate-filled morass. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
It's not an illusion. Food prices have gone up. The Labor Department's report on September prices shows a 1.2% increase in food costs, the biggest rise since a 5.6% spike in May when pandemic-related shutdowns at food processing plants triggered shortages. While the price of used cars jumped by the largest amount in more than half a century in September, inflation at the retail level was up just 0.2%, half of what it was in August. Energy prices also decreased slightly for the second consecutive month. For the past 12 months, inflation at the wholesale level is up just 4%, while core inflation, which doesn't consider food or energy prices, is up 1.2%. September's higher food costs were led by a rise in prices for corn, fresh vegetables, and beef. Though it's historically a swing state, Iowa went for Trump in the 2016 election. Trump's plans to host a rally in the Capitol tonight indicate the state's importance as a battleground for the 2020 presidential race. Mike Moen with the Public News Service has the story.
President Donald Trump holds a campaign rally in Iowa today. His visit signals how important the state has become in the presidential race and coincides with a host of struggles many residents are facing. In 2016, candidate Trump won Iowa by 9 points, leaving many pundits thinking it wouldn't be competitive in 2020. But the polls have tightened, and the Hawkeye State is now viewed as a toss-up a few weeks before the election. University of Northern Iowa political scientist Donna Hoffman says Iowa actually has a history of being a swing state, just not as consistently as others.
Every election cycle brings a unique set of characteristics to it. And we're seeing that manifest in 2020.
She says this time around, farmers who still express strong support for Trump have seen a mixed bag from trade policies. And this summer's derecho storm left Iowa fields flattened, reigniting concerns about the impacts of climate change. And Hoffman says protests over systemic racism were very visible in Iowa this year, likely leading to more activity from marginalized voters. Hoffman says the pandemic factor also could be playing a role in the tight polling results. Iowa is still among the states with higher coronavirus infection rates, and Governor Kim Reynolds, a staunch supporter of the president, has come under fire for her response to the crisis.
Governor Reynolds has not put in a mask mandate in the state, as many other governors, even Republican governors, have done in some other states that have seen high numbers.
President Trump himself has been criticized by opponents and health officials for not fully embracing mask use or carrying out a consistent message on the virus. Meanwhile, Hoffman says it will be interesting to see the impact of an executive order signed by Governor Reynolds this year, restoring the voting rights of convicted felons. Prior to the move, Iowa was the last state to still have such a ban. Mike Moen, Public News Service. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael says vote, no matter what.
Amy Barrett saying repeatedly she doesn't know how she'd vote on a case is like a cat saying she doesn't know if she'd eat a mouse until the mouse is in front of her, unprotected. Unless the Democrats have the moxie to throw in some procedural monkey wrenches, Barrett will be confirmed. And equal rights, the right to choose, affordable health care, economic justice, and maybe the right to choose a president are doomed, no matter who's president. The election still matters, intensely. People lined up around the block in Georgia and Texas to vote early. A cable was accidentally cut in Virginia, stopping people from registering online on the last day. The KKK left visit cards at homes of Biden supporters in Tennessee. Some Oregonians are freaking out because their ballots haven't arrived earlier than usual. We can't stop Barrett, but we can stop Trump. Maybe break McConnell's chokehold on the Senate. So vote. Help others to vote. Contribute to candidates who can unseat Republicans and incumbents who national Republicans have targeted to defeat. We're not victims or irrelevant. Our voices will be heard. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Brian Oster, Samantha Law, and Dan Raphael. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Megan Kamrick, Mike Moen, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Juneteenth Radio, bringing you the latest stories in African American and Black society. At 9, it's Fight the Empire, connecting historical events with what's going on right now. And at 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news journalism with Dennis Bernstein. All of our KBOO programming, including the evening news, is made possible by support from our members. We are currently in our fall membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Psilocybin-assisted therapy will be on the ballot this November, and KBOO is here to provide an overview of what the measure entails in order to help our listeners be informed voters on November 3rd. We spoke with Tom Eckert, a psychotherapist in Portland and one of the chief petitioners of the measure, as well as Mark Fettman, a psychiatrist in Portland who would like to see psilocybin-assisted therapy sometime in the future, but is unhappy with the conditions of the measure. Oregon Measure 109, the Psilocybin Program Initiative, will be on the ballot on November 3rd. A yes vote supports authorizing the Oregon Health Authority to create a program permitting licensed service providers to administer psilocybin to individuals 21 and older. A no vote opposes the creation of this program. If passed, the Oregon Health Authority would have 2 years to develop the program. People would only be allowed to purchase and consume psilocybin at the service center and under the direct supervision of the service provider after undergoing a preparation session. Over this 2-year period, OHA would determine what qualifications, education, and training are needed for the service providers and create a code of professional conduct for the facilitators. OHA would also be responsible for setting dosage standards and labeling and packaging the drug. Psilocybin, like marijuana, is still classified federally as a Schedule I drug by the Drug Enforcement Agency. In 2019, the Federal Drug Administration designated psilocybin therapy as a breakthrough therapy, a designation meant to, quote, expedite the development and review of drugs intended to treat a serious condition. And as the mental health crisis in the state is among the worst in the nation, many are hopeful that new therapies can help people suffering from depression, anxiety, and addiction. If this measure passes, Oregon would be the first state to legalize the use of psilocybin products. And, if passed, Measure 109 would still prohibit the possession, manufacturing, and consumption of psilocybin outside of designated service centers. The measure has garnered over 160,000 signatures from Oregon residents and has received support from U.S. Representative Earl Blumenauer, the Democratic Party of Oregon, Dr. Bronner Soapes, the ACLU of Oregon, and Moms United to End the War on Drugs. The Oregon Psychiatric Physicians Association opposes Measure 109. The Oregon Psilocybin Society, founded in 2016 by Portland psychotherapists Tom and Cherie Eckert, has been leading the Yes on 109 campaign. Here's Tom Eckert speaking to how he believes Measure 109 could help Oregonians.
Measure 109 is the psilocybin therapy initiative in Oregon. So what we're doing is we're advancing a framework that will allow access to psilocybin-assisted therapy. So psilocybin-assisted therapy, of course, has a growing body of research supporting its safety and efficacy, and it's going to help Oregonians address what's really become a mental health crisis across the state. We have some of the worst rates of mental health and mental illness in the country. So we're really looking for new therapeutic options that are effective. And this modality addresses all kind of a spectrum of mental health issues, ranging from depression and anxiety and even addictions, the lingering effects of trauma, things like that. So we see this as a really exciting approach to address some of our big issues here in Oregon.
The measure is for assisted psilocybin therapy. Here, Tom talks us through the experience.
You make a good point. We're advancing psilocybin therapy. So when we talk about therapy, we're actually talking about a sequence of sessions, a sequence of therapeutic sessions. Begins with a preparation session. So a client would come into a licensed facility and see a licensed facilitator and kind of get oriented to what's to come in terms of the next session, which would be the psilocybin session. There'd also be, in that first session, a kind of an assessment for potential contraindications, make sure that it's a really good fit moving forward. And then maybe a day or two later, you go into a psilocybin session itself, and that's where you have the experience. Of course, psilocybin is a natural compound found in lots of species of mushrooms, and so you ingest the psilocybin, and it takes you into an experience, and that's really hard to describe, as many who have dabbled in it would tell you. So I'm not even going to venture to try to describe the experience other than to say that it promotes a real flexibility of mind. And a lot of people who are struggling, whether it's with a diagnosed mental health issue or just in general in life, you know, our tendency is to get caught up in loops and patterns, and certainly depression and anxiety and addictions kind of fit into that spectrum of issues where we basically get stuck. And psilocybin has this way of creating a profound experience that promotes a flexibility of mind so that you can see yourself and see your world in a different way. And that brings up potentially insights and epiphanies and breakthroughs. And then after the experience winds down and you safely come to, nobody's leaving the facility, nobody's driving home well altered or anything like that. But once the psilocybin experience comes to an end, then a couple days later you have an integration session or a sequence of integration sessions. And that's where you do the kind of more active talk therapy to kind of talk about those insights and epiphanies and make them part of your practice moving forward in a kind of healing journey. And so that's why it's psilocybin therapy. So the psilocybin experience itself is very internal. It's not a talk therapy session. It's really working within your own energies, often with music playing or in a quiet room with just gentle affirmation from a facilitator. They really don't, kind of enter into the experience unless necessary. And that's kind of the way it works. And again, this is the modality that's been advancing at great institutions like Johns Hopkins and NYU and UCLA for a variety of addressing a variety of issues, including depression. And the outcomes have been really off the charts. So psychology, therapy, psychiatry, we really need a breakthrough therapy. And in fact, the FDA has identified psilocybin-assisted therapy as a breakthrough therapy, meaning that it's showing promise beyond what already exists. And that's what we need in Oregon.
The Oregon Psychiatric Physicians Association has publicly said it opposes Measure 109, largely because psilocybin has not yet passed through Phase 3 of FDA approval. Phase 3 of the FDA approval process involves several thousand patients that are monitored in clinics to carefully determine effectiveness and identify side effects. In their official opposition statement to Measure 109, OPPA says Measure 109 is unsafe and makes misleading promises to Oregonians struggling with mental illness. The OPPA is a district branch of the American Psychiatric Association, which has also said it opposes Measure 109. Here's psychiatrist Dr. Mark Fetman talking a little bit more about the process.
The medicines that psychiatrists use can, and, you know, potentially use, can be very helpful and are frequently very powerful, but they have to be vetted and tested. And in the United States, we have a procedure for doing that. And then medicines are prescribed and used by doctors as treatment. And psychiatrists are the mind doctors. And so this 109 leaves psychiatrists out of the picture. And I think that just does not make any sense. My objection is not that there may be a bad trip, but that in general, the way we do things in a safe manner in the United States is that we have a Food and Drug Administration that approves drugs, and then a Drug Enforcement Administration. Both are federal agencies that oversee the prescribing and use of medications or substances like this. However, in this case, this proposal would do an end run around that and not use the normal procedures in terms of how these things are utilized and offered as treatment to people.
If psychiatrists in Oregon wanted to administer psilocybin, they wouldn't be able to legally. Here's Mark Fetman explaining why.
Even if I wanted to participate in a clinic like the proposed ones that Oregon Health Association would be setting up, I couldn't do it or I'd lose my career because the DEA would take my DEA license away.
Despite all that, Eckert maintains that the psilocybin program could be absolutely safe and effective under the new initiative.
Well, I mean, I would challenge the idea of it being experimental, first of all. Psilocybin has been around forever. It's a natural compound. It's been used by human beings for hundreds, if not thousands of years in ceremonial contexts by Native peoples across the world. And in our Western context, psilocybin-assisted therapy was studied in the 1950s and 60s a lot, and all those studies pointed to it being a real therapeutic agent with an excellent safety track record. And then it was prohibited by Nixon in 1970 for political reasons, not scientific reasons, right? And so in the last 20 years, some really courageous research teams have broken through that red tape to do more research, really robust, rigorous research, again at Johns Hopkins, places like that. And it's just basically confirming what we already know, that psilocybin has an excellent safety record, and when managed in this careful therapeutic context, leads to amazing outcomes. So it's not experimental the way I look at it. It's something that we know a lot about. Psilocybin is not a pharma drug, right? This is not a new drug that's been cooked up in the lab that we don't know anything about. So if it was, it would go through a particular process through the FDA and whatnot. Now, psilocybin is moving through a FDA approval process, and in fact, the FDA has designated it a breakthrough therapy. But at root, psilocybin therapy is a therapeutic experiential modality. It's a therapeutic experience, okay? And I think so the right context for that is a therapeutic context. In other words, creating a safe setting, having a trained facilitator. But they're kind of looking at it through this lens that they want to kind of keep it as a pharma drug, and it can't be patented, and it's a different modality. I know that a lot of medical doctors, in fact, our polling shows that, you know, highly educated folks like medical doctors are generally in favor of this measure.
Measure 109 will be on the ballot this November. A yes vote supports the creation of a program permitting licensed service providers to administer psilocybin to individuals 21 and older. A no vote opposes the creation of this program. Don't forget to keep tuning in to KABU for continuous coverage on the issues and candidates we'll be seeing on the November ballot. And most importantly, don't forget to vote. For KABU, I'm Nat Moon.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kabu.fm.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KABU with news from your community radio station.
Well, good evening. You are listening to News from the Boo here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Jenny Yokoyama, and I'm also one of your interim station co-managers. Here on News from the Boo, we talk about all things KABU. We talk about just what's going on with all our volunteers and members, listeners, just anything that's got to do with KABU. So in the volunteer department, we just want to give a big thank you to everyone who turned in a program proposal recently for our program proposal drive. We got a lot of wonderful pilots that came in, and which means we'll have some new programmers on the air really soon. So we just want to thank everybody who submitted something. And so everybody stay tuned. Tune on in to hear our latest KABU volunteers on the air. They'll probably hear them coming up in a couple weeks. And if you are someone who is thinking, oh, I'd like to volunteer for KABU and I missed a program proposal, don't worry, it's okay. You can still submit a program proposal. We always have open program proposals on our website, but that doesn't necessarily mean we always have open slots or anything like that. But people are always welcome to turn in a program proposal if you ever have an idea for a show that you think